I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you a novel idea. In some cultures, women face challenges that we here in the West hardly can imagine. Some are sent off to a role of servitude with other family members, or experience female circumcision, or marry young in an arranged marriage, yet emerge as the remarkable women they were born to be. Today we explore stories of women and families whose lives were filled with strength and challenge. Shugri Saeed Sall was born in Somalia and as a young girl was sent to the desert to live with her nomadic grandmother and help tend their goats and camels. Lessons learned there created a foundation of strength and courage, which helped her survive as her country was torn apart by civil war and as she eventually made her way to a life in North America. Her book is The Last Nomad, Coming of Age in the Somali Desert, and we'll talk with her in just a minute. A young couple's secret love letters, written a century ago in Gujarat, India, are finally translated to expose the sensuality of young love, the disappointment of separation, and the trials of living according to rigid traditions. Artist Hemu Agarwal discovered over 500 letters in an attic after her father died, and after many years decided to carefully translate these remnants of her parents' young lives and love. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. The life of desert nomads involves constant relocation, following the changes of seasons and weather, always looking for water and forage. Many people in Somalia today still rely on the animals they can raise and sell and trade for the goods they need. Somalia is often labeled a failed state. It suffers from drought, poverty and starvation, violence and internal unrest, and has for many years now. Its post-colonial existence has been largely unstable, and the violence brought on by the Somali Civil War in the 1990s contributed to the many, many Somalis who have fled their homeland. Somalia, however, is also known for its poets and tradition of storytelling. Shugri Saeed Sall was born in the Somali desert and for her formative years lived as a desert nomad, helping her grandmother tend the goats and camels that were their livestock and beasts of burden. Her experience there shaped her and gave her the grit to subsequently survive life in an orphanage, navigate the dangerous streets of Mogadishu, and ultimately find her way to North America. Shugri's memoir, The Last Nomad, Coming of Age in the Somali Desert, is a bit of clear-eyed storytelling of her unimaginable life and transformation from desert nomad to writer and medical professional whose home is now California. Shugri, I'm so glad to talk to you today about this book. It seems so timely. You spent your formative years growing up in Somalia, and today this is a place where drought is killing livestock and drought is killing people.
Yeah.
And it's a very dangerous place to live. People are killing people.
Yeah.
But as a girl, you learned your most important life lessons while tending goats and migrating with the weather across the land on the backs of camels. So let's start there. In your life as the last nomad?
Thank you so much, Suzanne. Like I told you, said before, I am a daughter of a well-educated father and a nomadic mother. And I was born as my mother is fourth daughter. One thing to understand was my young mother married my father when she was no more than 15. So when she lived from the nomadic world, she was really ultimately her mother's helper, you know. And she knew that she would have to sacrifice one of her daughter to that world. What really meant to us, she needed to give one of her daughter to my grandmother, Maya Yeo, to be an helper. But that meant that child wasn't going to get an education or grow up with the rest of the family. I was born as her fourth daughter, tipping the scale in her favor. The book actually starts the first chapter called In the Nomad after the prologue. It really starts with a chase. I think it's soon after my mother dropped me. For a curious child, the desert really held my imagination, you know. But at the same time, I didn't understand what it meant. Like I said, not growing up with the rest of my family and sibling. And I grew up under the Mr. Regal, the woman who tamed the desert was my grandmother. So I don't think I missed out a lot. And I didn't know that as a child, even if I had, you know, missed out.
And you eventually do get education. And I want to talk about your father in a little bit. But your life with your grandmother, your Ayeo, was something that I think you said something like, watching her, I became fearless. I became a fearless child. And she herself was unique, that she really managed a lot and did a lot independently. And maybe that too you didn't know was unusual. Talk a little bit about her.
Yeah, it's an honor. My grandmother was, you know, this, like I said, 6 feet tall woman, dark skin, who literally in a time, to me, she was the earliest feminist. If she didn't like a husband, she composed to him a cerebral complex poem while he's sitting right there and insulted him. You know? And so there was, from the time she was 12, she was creating poems and doing things. And to me, honestly, as a child, I took that for granted. I thought every other woman tamed camel. I thought every other woman was a camel herder. It was not until later when I was writing this book that my sister, Arafa, who is in the story, said, actually, that was not the case, you know, that was not the case. Of course, women did a lot of work, but my grandmother, I think, went beyond that. You know, I describe in one night when we were attacked by a lion, and here was my grandmother, you know, she was holding a torch and her body language as she head into darkness and come back with even more defiance. To me, watching her as a child not have fear, really it's why I am fearless and I am who I am. I think our formative years shape who we are. So in a way, I am so grateful to grow up under the shadow of a poet, a brilliant mind, amazing woman, a woman who showed from early on that I don't need a man to be enough. And if she didn't like it, she divorced them. So I think it was an honor growing up under my grandmother.
It seemed like that time in life really made you as tough as she was in a way, because you had a lot of things to face when you went back to living with your family. And I should mention that your mother died when you were maybe just 6 years old. And your mother also was a pretty remarkable woman in that she, if she had to come back to the desert, she amazingly found her clan of people where they were. But she also was rather entrepreneurial too. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about your mother, who you lost so young.
Yeah, my mother was actually the reason I decided to write. I describe her being a mirage that refused to give back the promise it once held. And I think, as I described, there was no pictures of her. And I find myself really a memory, my mom's memory of her fading away. I did not want this woman who gave birth to 10 children and lived 20, you know, was married to my father somewhat like 20 years, her, you know, her memory to die. And it wasn't really easy excavating that world of my mother, because many people, when you ask them, like the Somalis of today would say, oh, brave for her, or she was a good wife. And I said, yeah, I need to know more about my mom. So in the end, I was able to cobble together from the stories of my mom, from my older sisters, from my brother, and even my fleeting memory. And what really came out was, you know, I painted her in words, what I couldn't do in pictures or what I couldn't see in pictures. So I think, like I describe in one scene of my mother when she is literally 9 months pregnant and she is, you know, walking, trying to find the land of my nomadic grandmother. Keep in mind, nomads move so often. So if you knew one place, they are in another place next time you go. What's really interesting is that it's not like you have a building or address. You know, these people will just walk and ask the closest family, closest people they come upon the desert. You know, hey, you know, did you know where so-and-so and family? And so they have to be a great navigators to navigate the endless desert. And in this scene, my mother heard something coming from an animal enclosure called Hero. And she walked into the animal enclosure and 15 hyenas jumped out of, like, of the fences that they, you know, she startled them. And I remember, you know, they described her saying, "Awugil adab," which means when your forefather is go to hell, you know. It is beautiful that she survived. It is beautiful. I mean, she was an amazing woman and who taught us also so many lessons and taught us to have respect for the desert and a city alike. And we had a very unique life. When school closed, before I was even given as a gift of labor, we used to go to the desert and then come back again and come to the city and back and forth. So she was another person, a fierce person to grow up under. I mean, this woman, really, I am who I am because of them. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit also about your father, because he was a stern man and thought nothing of physical force to reprimand his children or to teach lessons. And he had many wives and many children, but he was progressive in his wanting his daughters to be educated, which really wasn't the norm
for that time. Yeah.
For that time. So talk a little bit about your father and your relationship with him.
You know, my father was a man of his time. You know, at one point he was progressive. He actually wanted to educate his daughter. He said, if you educate a son, you educate that son. But if you educate a daughter, you educate a whole village. And it was a beautiful thing. I think all his daughters, you know, he seek that. But at the same time, you know, my father was a very serious man. And I talked about being four and at 4 a.m. being waken up to take an Arabic lesson and Quranic lessons and, you know, the fear I have of him. And, you know, so he was a complex character, but I really did not want to. No one should write a book to get revenge on somebody. I think my father, if anything, come out just as complex human like many of us are. There is the good, the ugly, and the in between that lives with us. And the good thing, you know, we all want to just stay in the middle, not to lean into the peripheral areas. But I think honestly, I just understand to him for the man he is. And I know my brother who really have a hard time with it. In the end, I think it killed him. I mean, the pain of mental anguish of the trauma he went to endure, not only from my father, but from so many places, including Somali civil war. So
I want to pick up on what you just said about nobody should write a book for revenge, because the tone of your book really is reflective without being overly emotional or histrionic. And I really was struck by the way you so frankly talked about female circumcision also known as female genital mutilation. You talk about it so frankly and without a lot of emotion, with the exception of the courage that act gave you in a way. You describe the procedure and its aftermath. You describe how you chose not to scream or struggle. Mm-hmm. But this is what you knew in life, so you had no reason to judge it the way the rest of the world did.
Well, I think I wanted to capture, first of all, I wanted to really give insight to female circumcision, and also to give insight to understanding of our culture and why we practice it, you know. And then if you understand something and you know the rationale of why people are doing, perhaps you can come at them and say, hey, how could we do things better? How could we change? Using, you know, communicating with people, it has happened to them or it's happening to them, to put it. So to me, I honestly, some say, were you like, it sounds like you were okay with female circumcision. Absolutely not. You know, that's why my two daughters are not circumcised. And it's a horrific, horrific thing. In fact, the other day I saw it on Facebook, a young girl who was getting circumcised, and it felt so foreign to me. And I said, are we doing this thing now? I think when it is happening and you're not seeing a picture of it of a young girl, you know, they were giving her a candy to drink her after she went to the precision, but something about it felt viscerally painful watching this innocent, beautiful dark-skinned girl with the soft hair, like, do that. And I felt I was very troubled by it. And so I honestly just want people to understand. And as a children, you know, as a child, I wanted to say, you know, no one, my grandmother was actually doing me a favor. No one would marry me had I not been circumcised. I think that is the thing I wanted to make you understand. You know, if I was still in Somalia and was not circumcised, you know, most men will stay clear of me and other people will shape me. So my grandmother didn't want somebody saying, oh, that poor girl, no one cared to circumcise. But like they said, when we know better, we do better. And I know better. And there's no way my daughter is going to be circumcised. You know, so that's how I look at it.
I appreciated your frankness in talking about it and in talking about your experience. And from what I perceived, that event in your life was also one that maybe helped manifest your life's courage because of the way you approached that. As a young girl, you weren't going to cry. And your description in the book was just really arresting, that you said, no, you didn't want to be held. And so was that a defining act in your life?
In a way, you're right. You know, I didn't want to be held down when I was circumcised because, you know, for one thing, I'm a very stubborn child. And I always liked to, you know, I had so much respect for my grandmother. You know, I was one of those kids that were always brave, who was always trying to try new things. You know, I even think perhaps that's why my mother chose me, because she saw early on this stubbornness, you know, which is helpful to be in the desert, in this bravery, you know. And so I'm not 100% sure, but maybe I have, you know, I inherited that from probably my family. But then there's that innately born stubbornness that I hope.
It actually, I think, was what allowed you to then make the radical transitions that you had to make over the next several years of your life, of being in an orphanage and then as things degraded in Somalia. I mean, even just adjusting to living in the city, and then you had to go to Kenya. So I guess I want our listeners to understand how difficult life became. Rather rapidly, it seemed. It seemed like almost overnight you were in an orphanage and then things were starting to degrade in Somalia rather quickly.
Yeah, I think that basically it in a span of time, it feels like very fast, but it did take maybe like 6-7 years, I think. But you're right. It was, you know, life was difficult. And I think, sorry to spoil for people, after the death of my mother, you know, I think had my mother lived, I don't think my grandmother would have released me. So it's almost like my mother had to die for me to have the life I live today. And it's in a twisted thing, you know. And after that, we end up in an orphanage. And, you know, and then soon we were running for our life. All Somalis, civil war, marked us for death, many of us. And we were just really didn't know. It was the disarray of chaos, of confusion, and who's killing who, what this tribe, what do they want? It's, you know, I was wrapped up in the invisibility of an early teen, you know, and quite confused. I was like, many adults also thought this is a temporary thing. So, you know, in this book, what I did, Suzanne, is I weave early times. You know, I weave how life was in Somalia. In every time I show you how peace looked like, you know, and then when peace was no longer there, how it looked like. So you see me in the mundane day of me going to the markets, you know, going to high school, having crashes, you know. And then you see me running for my life as the food becomes scarce, as we get attacked lions by the borders, you know, toward the, when we were heading to the borders, men trying to rape us, other clan, Kenyan man. It was just a never ending of atrocity. I described a Somali young woman who were crossing to Kenyan border like a buffalo crossing the crocodile filled river. Yes. And it was really truth for many of us, you know. They were like, where are this beautiful young woman is streaming from, who did not have, like, you know, who were displaced, you know, and no one to look after you at times, you know, and you didn't have papers, we didn't have, so I talk about even going to jails, in Kenyan jails, just because I was illegal, you know. And but like I said, I also show you the heart, you know, the beauty of falling in love, the first love, and how it feels in the beautiful Nairobi, and how I really enjoy when I get to know the Kenyan people, not the soldiers, you know. And it's like the ISIS on the border, and then people seeing how the American people, there are a lot of people with amazing you know, generosity. And so it's like that. When you are in the border, you're dealing with people who are very cruel, who have no, you know, look at you as, how could I make money out of you? Don't enter my country. And then the Kenyan people were really quite different, you know, and like everything in life. And I think a lot of people said, Shukri, I actually laugh out loud when I was reading. You're quite funny. And yes, I managed to make people laugh where I'm still giving them some serious stories, yeah. And I think we never want, as human beings, to lose our sense of humor. I am sharing this story because really, Susan, I believe stories have a way of reminding us our shared humanity. And I often even tell, you know, when we try to reject people who are coming through the border, that's not my problem, you know. And we know their story, we have compassion for it, you know. And I often always say also, don't be like so entitled, like that cannot happen to me, because anything immediate can hit us, a bad earthquake can hit us, God forbid, we'd be running to Mexico. And that's what they say, be nice to your neighbors. So yeah, that's how I see in this world.
I like the way you've characterized your book. That's actually, you know, how I perceived it as well, that you could talk about what seemed to be very disorienting sorts of activities, yet there always seemed to be this familial connection that helped take you from one place to another. And I want to say just your womanhood, your young womanhood, and the emotions you express were something so relatable. Yeah. And in a unrelatable sort of situation for many of us. But that you also managed to stay connected with your family enough to get you eventually to Canada. It seems like your life in Canada, at one point you said you felt invisible and lonely, But you had people who kind of guided you or pointed you in directions. You met the man who you married, and you've gone on to get educated and have a good life. I guess I wonder if you could just talk about that sort of transition from your life as a nomad and then to come into a completely different culture.
Yeah, I think it was shocking because by the time I arrived in Canada, we've been, I think, displaced almost at least a year and a half, you know. But I also lived in Nairobi where I felt, you know, alive, and I was hearing, you know, Nairobi, like I said, there is it's a melting cultures as well. You know, Somalis live there. There's a lot of, you know, Arabs that live there. And it's a hub for a lot of other cultures. You know, it has a lot of embassies, so a lot of refugees are there to take advantage of those, you know, deal with the embassies and move to other, you know, countries, right? But I also being young and having all these boys having crushes on you. I remember the Kukui boy, Kunin, which meant girl, come and talk to me. I don't know what it means. I later learned a little bit of this crashing the way they were describing. But then you arrive Canada where the bus, you know, the bus arrives precisely the time it says, you know, in Nairobi, the bus was hustling and bustling and everybody was like, they're trying to get their attention. And I describe, but also the bus arrives on time, but no one really knows you. In Africa, I felt seen when I first, you know, always, but in Canada and Western cultures, I felt invisible. And that is a normal for a lot of us. The food feels strange, it's a new language, new everything. So while you're getting used to it, it really takes time to chew it, you know, and swallow it. So it's not a bitter or it's not hard and tearing up your esophagus. But I was also going through a lot. The situation at home wasn't good. I wasn't making any friends in Canada at that early time, took some time. But more than anything, you know, for some, my type of beauty I felt was more appreciated in Africa than it was in Canada. So it's just here as a young girl at the height of her time. And I really felt very invisible. And I think that's why the book is what it is, because there's a lot of honesty to that. And a lot of people say to me, I really remember feeling that the food, everything you're describing, I felt arriving in Western cultures, you know? Yes. And I'm assuming if you had to go to Africa, you probably will feel, but I don't know, Africa has a way of being so alive. People, if you ask people direction, they will literally take you to hold you by the hand and take you there, the place. Sometimes I remember in I shouldn't say all Africa, but at least places that I had experience with it, you know, Kenya and Ethiopia and Somalia. You know.
Have you traveled back there since you've made your life here in America?
You mean all Africa in generally, or Kenya,
or Somalia, any of those places?
Ethiopia, I go there. I went there multiple times because that's where my husband is from. Kenya, no. If I'm gonna go to Kenya, the plan was to visit Somalia. Somalia and I really owe each other some kind of closure, but I am really, truly traumatized. And the fact that Somalia is, you know, the fact that Somalia, even as of yesterday, two days ago, there was a huge explosion that killed so many people.
Yes.
I left in terror, and I'm not willing to go back in terror as well, you know? I mean, our country has been in war. You know, a lot of people were telling, oh, it's so beautiful. Yes, Somalia is beautiful. We have the longest water shore in Africa. But we're dealing a madman of Al-Shabaab and extremists, you know. I mean, the Somalia I am nostalgic for and the Somalia that exists are not quite aligning. You know, I want to go to Somalia, sift my fingers through the sand, listen to great music I once did, go to the market, feel like almost I want to go back the way it was. I should not have a fear of the country that I, my birth country, but I am hopeful for my country. I am very hopeful, and I hope one day that I could go back and enjoy my Somalia. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, Somalia is known as a nation of poets, and you grew up with the tradition of storytelling, and you're sure carrying it on. And Shugri, I appreciated your opening up my eyes.
Oh, well, I appreciate you reading, Suzanne, because not a lot of people read other people's culture, and you took the time to read it. And it's the people like you who's getting this book really out there. I truly appreciate it, you know. Thank you so much, Suzanne. And I really appreciate our talk today.
My conversation with Shugri Saeed Saul, and her book is The Last Nomad. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Hemu Agarwal is an artist and has illustrated many record album covers, advertising campaigns, and product designs. But her discovery of 500 secret letters sent between her parents just about a century ago encouraged her to translate them from Gujarati, the native Indian language in which they were written. The resulting book is The Forbidden Letters, A True Story, which contains a bit of cultural history of the time to frame the roughly 200 of these letters she shares between the two lovers, who, even after they were married, according to custom, kept these letters and their communication while separated secret from the rest of the family. Hemu, through these letters, exposes taboos of the time, the hardships women endured in the family structure, and the intense love of young Pran, who married at the age of 13, and her husband Rai, 18, at the time of their arranged marriage. Let's listen to our conversation. Welcome to talk with us today about your book, The Forbidden Letters, a True Story. Hemu, this is a story of a young couple in Gujarat, India, and they were in an arranged marriage, which is very typical of that time and even of this time. Rai was 18 and Pran was just 13, but this wasn't really unusual. In fact, it was somewhat the norm. And your book is part of their story, their love story told through letters. And as the title suggests, this sort of communication was a forbidden act, even for a married couple. And they had to employ some trusted uncles to be the conduits of these letters. So before we get too far into it, why was it forbidden, or a matter of what they called modesty, for a married couple to write letters to each other, even after they have had children together? So talk about why it was forbidden, if you know that.
Yes, certain behavior was because of modesty, because of keeping something very private. They took it upon themselves. They did not want family members to know that they were writing to each other, even though they were married, even though they had children. They just wanted, they were so bashful. It was not a forbidden by law, but it was a behavior accepted in certain families that they would not do it openly. And even though they were separated for 8 years and they kept writing letters, but letters remain a secret. Even after they stopped writing letters and we all children were born and grew up with them, we never knew that these letters existed. So it was a very well kept secret.
These were As you just alluded, these were also your parents. So tell us how these century-old letters were discovered and how you decided to share them in this form and to translate them.
Yes, as I said, while I was growing up with them, I had no idea they were writing these letters existed. But what happened is I found these letters accidentally on June 8, 1978. That is the day after Rai passed away. Rai is the man who wrote half of the letters. The letters, nearly 500 of them, written between the years 1923 and 1931, were stored for 47 years in a metal trunk, bundled by the year and dates in chronological order. It was a complete surprise because letters were never mentioned. It was like a family secret. I took the trunk to Pran and asked, "What should I do with these letters?" And she, still grief-stricken because her husband had passed away only a day before, said calmly, "Throw them away." Mm-hmm. I was taken back by her reply. I asked her if I could have them, and she said yes. So I brought the letters with me when I returned to the U.S. in the same month. But then they stayed in my attic for additional 34 years. Until 2012, when I finally decided to do something with them, I had no heart to throw them away. And when I started to read them, I realized how wonderful these letters are. And I must bring them to attention to my children, their children, and maybe the rest of the world. That's when I started to take it seriously and put it in the book form for world to read.
Well, it's interesting that that was Pran's immediate response to get rid of them, because I believe that she wasn't initially keeping them and that it was Rai who asked her to keep them. And so it seemed like he might have been the one who wanted to keep these precious letters.
Yes, that is true. That is true. Matter of fact, during the year 1923 and 1924, all the letters from Rai are destroyed because Pran was destroying them after reading. She was so afraid that this letter will be found. But the letters going from Pran to Rai, all of them were saved by Rai. When Rai realized that Pran was not keeping the letters, he told her to keep the letters and that he would collect from her. And so from that on, from 1925 onwards, all the letters Rai kept with him. And that's why they survived.
Yes. What were some of the challenges of translation? Not merely their writing, but each has their own character that is expressed in their letters. And of course, you knew these people. And there are some poems included as well that you've translated. So talk a little bit about your process of translating from, would that be Gujarati, the language?
Yeah, it's Gujarati. Yeah, it's a state of Gujarat in India. It's a northwestern state. And the language, that state is a Gujarati language. It's my mother tongue. I speak very well. I read all the letters. The first grueling task was selecting which one to include. It was impossible to put all 500 letters in one book. But then the second, even more difficult, was to translate them in English. If translated word to word, it would make no sense. So I took sentences or sometimes the entire paragraph and translated the sentiments expressed in coherent English. The prime focus in translating was to capture their emotions without losing readability. I hired three professionals in India to translate these letters. And they did it for first 15 letters and they gave up the job. So the whole thing fell on my lap. And I spent several years just to translate them very carefully, choosing the words that would express and for English readers who would be able to understand what the letters were saying. Fran had only third grade education, and her sentences ran into each other. She hardly used any punctuation marks. The letters of the early years are filled with vivid imaginations. For example, she compares her extreme pain and distress brought about by the separation from her husband to the suffering of a fish cast away on dry land. In another one, she describes how his letters felt like cold water being poured on her heart that was burning with fire. She was very expressive, although she had a limitation in language-wise, but she expressed freely, and these letters are written beautifully that one gets a complete image of how they were in pain being away from each other.
It also perhaps exposed a part of their lives and their love and their relationship that perhaps you were unaware of. And I'm wondering what surprised you most about Prawn and Rye, because these are people you knew as parents long after their initial separation in these forbidden letters. So what surprised you most?
After reading these letters, I came to know their most intimate feelings, how they madly love one another. We all know our parents as a parent, but this was a window that opened for me to take a peek deeply into their lives as two human beings, two lovers, when young and vibrant. And it was, I felt very extremely lucky to read into their thoughts when they were young, and also they are describing in the letters what kind of future they would like, and they were able to bring that future the way they had said in those letters some 30 years ago or something, whenever they became independent of a joint family. And so it was amazing for me to read. I feel very fortunate, because many parents and we children, we really don't talk to each other. We hardly hi, hello, and every day how is the weather. But how they felt when they were young, we never know. So I felt very lucky to have this letter saved for me to see their personal life.
They were separated. And as we said, I mean, Prawn was really just a girl and Rye was young too. And they were separated because Rye was going to school and then starting a career. And Prawn was left with his family, where she was essentially a servant. She seemed, though, and this came through in the letters, a little bit feisty and forward-thinking and reflective on the role of women and kind of this family structure where she had to live with her husband's family. However, she also got pregnant quite early and repeatedly, and two of her young sons died. And she also suffered an illness, yet she was still expected to be obedient to the demands of her mother-in-law. And in fact, one of her daughters, one of Prawn's daughters, was given to a sister-in-law who had had several miscarriages. So Prawn just must have been a tower of strength to endure all this. And so talk a little bit about her evolution during the course of these 8 years.
Yes, she had to face a lot of difficulties. She was married when she was 13 years old. However, it took another year before she went to her in-laws' house to live with them. So she was 14 at that time. it was a customary for a married woman to live in a joint family system and obey their parents-in-law and also take care of their brothers-in-law, sisters-in-law, and other relatives. That was a norm, and it still is actually in India. Many women live with their in-laws, and that is expected of them to be adjusted to the new life and a new family. But in Prahlad's case, what happened is there were, in that family, there were four brothers. And Rai was the second brother. Rai was the only one away in the college, 500 miles away. The rest of the brothers and their wives, they were at home. So Prahlad was left out. Her husband was away. So she was given all the tasks which needed to be taken care of at early morning or late in the night, because her mother-in-law thought her husband is not here, so she is free, she is not busy, and the other women have to take care of their husbands. So that way, a lot of grueling tasks fell on Fran's shoulder, and she was young, but still she had to take care of a lot of duties. For example, every morning get up 5 in the morning, and first she had to grind wheat, because every day you make a fresh bread in India, it's called roti. And it's not like that you make a loaf and put it in the oven. No, each single roti has to be rolled out. And in the family, being 9-10 people, each person would eat 4 to 5 rotis. So you have to grind enough of wheat to make a dough roll out 50 very thin rotis and make them for the entire family. This task was assigned to Pran, and every day she had to fulfill that. The other things, like she had to churn the butter, she had to make buttermilk for the entire family, and a lot of things. She had to do it in a very tender age. And she felt terrible during my father's absence. She missed him, and she had to face with all these difficulties. And her mother-in-law was a tough lady. It was a little bit hard to put up with her. And then the children were born. And as you mentioned, one of her daughter was given away, and it was very heartbreaking for her. But she could not speak. See, in the joint family, elder make a decision and the younger one has to follow. So Rai could not oppose it, and she could not speak up. And so she had to give up her daughter. And that became very difficult for Pran not to see her daughter sometime for a year or 2 years in a row.
Her feelings of loss and separation were expressed quite directly and overtly to Rai, and sometimes quite forcefully. So he was in the position of trying to console her and encourage her, and he had to be obedient too. So he was in the position of having to be in the middle of all this and be away. I don't know, as reading them, I found it all kind of difficult, and I really felt for Pran, because at the same time she was suffering from an illness that took her a while to overcome.
Yes, she had to, beside every daily chore, she had to deal with her physical condition. She was suffering from a disease called scrofula. Scrofula that is similar to tuberculosis, not exactly tuberculosis, but the treatment is similar to that. She was sent to sanatorium for many, many months to recover. She had tumors on her neck area, and they were painful. And she had a young children. She also had to face with the death of 2 of her sons. One was under 4.5 months, and other was around 6 months. See, children mortality was also very common in those days. but the doctors in those days could not diagnose them very well, and children died very quickly. That was one of the reasons families have many more children, because they always are afraid they're going to lose one, two, or three of them. So Pran went through these tragedies and the disease, on top of them, all these rules and regulations. Yes.
Rai and Pran were Jains, and I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about the Jain religion, because some of our listeners might not be familiar with it.
Yeah, Jainism is a parallel religion to Buddhism. The both religions were equally rooted in India. Jainism is a far more strict religion than any other religion, because Jains believe that all the lives are sacred. The lives are given by God, and we must preserve it. That's why Jains will not even kill mosquitoes or even bed bugs or any tiny creature. They will not kill it. They are all strictly vegetarians. They do not eat meat or fish or any other living things. Of course, vegetables are also a part of living things because they grow. They have a life in them. But that is the smallest form of lives. They ate them to survive. But they, Pran and Rai were very firm believer in saving all the lives on the earth. And they also, in Jain religion, believes in fasting. So Pran and Rai did once a week fast 24 hours, not to eat or drink a water. And they followed all the rules and regulations of Jainism. They believed in reincarnation. They believed that if you do wrong things, you are accumulating bad karma. And a lot of bad karma gives you an inferior birth in the next life. But if you collect all the good karmas, how do you collect good karmas? Is by being nice, being good, gentle, saving lives, and living a moral life. You accumulate good karma. Then your life in your next birth is of a superior quality. Human beings are considered highly superior form of life compared to those animals and insects. And the Jain religion is one of them. They don't believe in war, they don't believe in struggle, they don't believe in killing or hurting even each other. Once a year, we have a festival called Paryushana, and that's a one-week festival. It's simply asking forgiveness from other people. If I hurt you in any way, please forgive me. And everybody says this to each other, their family, neighbors, office workers, that if I hurt you in any way, please forgive me. They believed in asking for forgiveness. That is their that's how they live their lives. Yes.
And Rai would sometimes console Pran and encourage her to focus on her Jain practices if she got just frustrated with her situation. And so this is something that they talked about and expressed in the letters. And you say some things early in the book that I found kind of thought-provoking, more about the history in India, that when India was a Hindu country, and we're talking maybe 1,000 years ago, that women were regarded quite differently, and that sexuality was also practiced more openly, fully. I mean, we just need to think about the Kama Sutra, but that it was then the Muslim influence that changed all that. And that, of course, when the British came in, things degraded further. So I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about what you know about that.
Ancient Indian women before 12th century enjoyed high status. They were equal to men and relished the same rights and privileges as men. They were educated, took part in wars and businesses, and were respected in every field in society, surpassing contemporary civilizations in ancient Greece and Rome. After the Muslim invasion of India in the 12th century, women's status transformed. Women got pushed back within the four walls of their homes. Father or husband ensured the safety of the girl, so fathers were eager to hand over their responsibilities to their husbands as early as possible. They considered a girl child a burden and liability. And so after 12th century onward, a lot of things changed. Then after British came to power in the later half of the 18th century, Indians, including women's conditions, deteriorated to their lowest level. British Empire drained India's wealth and resources. India's global export fell from 27% to 2%. They destroyed the robust textile industry. The education level declined, and educating women seemed unnecessary. Women could not lay claim to an inheritance. But around 1920, the Gandhi movement appealed to women, bringing a profound change in women's condition.
Gandhi was active in the Gujarat region of India. It seems like he is mentioned many times in the letters as well.
Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, as we call him, he was Gujarati. He was born in Gujarat. But he was a father figure to the entire country. And his movement affected the whole country. And his movement was a non-violence movement. Martin Luther King is very much influenced by Gandhi movement.
I'm talking with Hemu Agarwal, and her book is The Forbidden Letters, A True Story. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. And I hope people enjoy the book, read the book, and get a little bit of knowledge about India and India's people. Thank you, Suzanne.
My conversation with Hemu Agarwal on her book, The Forbidden Letters. Earlier, we visited with Shugri Sal with her memoir, The Last Nomad, Coming of Age in the Somali Desert. I thank both of these authors for talking with us, and I thank you for listening. I am Suzanne Lang, and I have production assistance from Will Penny and Mark Prell at KRCB. We are a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. Listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org. Follow the program or podcast links. It's a novel idea.